Well, if you've been here over the last few weeks, you may remember then how Matthew chapter 5 verse 20 fulfills a particular role. It's an introductory verse. It introduces that whole block of material that we've been working through in recent weeks that takes you up to the end of chapter 5. Well, chapter 6 verse 1 is similar to chapter 5 verse 20. It too is an introductory verse. It introduces this new block of material that will take us up to verse 18 of this chapter. And notice, in fact, that there's a phrase which features in both these verses I'm talking about, in chapter 5 verse 20 and in chapter 6 verse 1. It's the phrase, "your righteousness." And there in chapter 5 then, by that word righteousness, Jesus means moral righteousness, sexual behavior, verbal integrity, treatment of others, that kind of thing. And the scribes and Pharisees then, who are so influential in Jesus' day, they have their standards in those areas. They have their ideas about what is right and what is wrong. They have their brand of moral righteousness, but it's deficient. It's warped, it's thoroughly rotten, and so from verse 21 onwards there in chapter 5, Jesus ruthlessly dismantles it. Here now in chapter 6, however, he shifts the focus to a different strand, a different branch, if you like, of righteousness. What I'm going to call, for want of a better term, religious righteousness, specifically giving, praying, and fasting. And again then, Jesus has in his mind a deficient brand of religious righteousness that must have been prevalent in first century Israel. That's why he begins with that strong word, beware, there in verse 1. And although this time he doesn't actually mention the scribes and Pharisees by name, almost certainly in the context, it's their deficient brand of religious righteousness that he's thinking of. And so I simply want to ask the question this morning, how is it deficient? What's the problem with their religious righteousness? And I have four headings, the first three of which clarify what the problem is not, and the last of which clarifies what the problem is. So here goes then. First of all, the problem is not the righteousness. The problem is not the righteousness. So Jesus isn't saying here, look, there's no such thing as religious righteousness. That's a bogus category. All that matters is being pure and honest and kind, those great ethical requirements. That's all that God is interested in. Giving and praying and fasting, on the other hand, they are irrelevancies concocted by the scribes and Pharisees as yet another evasion tactic. The only kind of righteousness that I recognize is moral righteousness. He doesn't say that. No, he says, beware of practicing your religious righteousness, dot, dot, dot. In other words, beware of practicing it in a certain way, but it doesn't say beware of practicing religious righteousness, full stop, because it's inherently problematic. In fact, as he continues in chapter 6, he just assumes, doesn't he, that his disciples will give, and they will pray, and they will fast. By the way, the paragraph on fasting lies outside of our passage this morning. That's because, of course, having gotten onto the theme of prayer, Jesus goes on a bit of a digression which will end up yielding one of the most famous literary items the world has ever known. But it means that it's not until quite a bit later on that he gets back on track again and deals with fasting. But as I say, he just assumes throughout this passage that his disciples will engage in these activities. Verse 2, when you give. Verse 3, when you give. Verse 4, you're giving. Verse 5, when you pray. Verse 6, when you pray. Clearly then, Jesus is every bit as committed to the concept of religious righteousness as the scribes and Pharisees are. And I think that's a point worth making this morning. inevitably from time to time, you encounter professing Christians who are very tight on this kind of thing. You know, you must have a quiet time every day that is never less than an hour. You must never miss a Sunday service, even if you're so ill that you'll probably be dead before the third hymn is out. You must say grace before every meal in such a comprehensive manner that you touch on every major point of Christian doctrine in doing so. And then one day it comes to light that behind all this, a lifestyle of abject immorality was taking place. There was sexual perversion going on, or there was domestic abuse, or there was financial dishonesty. And the impressive religious righteousness then, it was all just an empty legalistic facade. You encounter that sometimes, don't you? And I guess it's very easy, isn't it, to react to that by rejecting religious righteousness altogether and developing a kind of profound distrust of church and worship and prayer and any talk of a personal walk with the Lord and all that kind of thing. I'm done with that stuff. My Christianity, it's me at 9 till 5, Monday to Friday, in my workplace or in my school or wherever, doing good and being different and leading a countercultural lifestyle. Forget devotional and experiential stuff. I'll leave that domain to the hypocrites. This is my Christianity. Thank you very much. That's an understandable reaction. And it's a reaction containing with it some great emphases, because, of course, that countercultural lifestyle, 9 till 5, Monday to Friday, is so important. But it's a wrong reaction all the same. Because the righteousness then of Jesus' disciples, and we're not talking here, of course, about that righteousness that has to do with our salvation, our being declared righteous by God the judge on the basis of Jesus' perfect obedience. We're talking about the righteousness that we practice throughout our Christian lives, having been declared righteous by God. That righteousness of Jesus' disciples, it's a dual thing. Yes, there's a strand of it relates to things like purity and honesty and kindness. Of course there is. And that's what we've been looking at these last few weeks. But there's this other strand of it, which relates to things like giving and praying and fasting, what we're calling this morning religious righteousness. And so we must never react then, overreact to that empty legalistic facade that we've far too often encountered by rejecting the concept altogether. So that's the first thing. The problem is not the righteousness. Secondly, the problem is not the reward. The problem is not the reward. So in verse 2 and verse 5 then, Jesus connects this deficient brand of religious righteousness with receiving a reward. And I guess then we can easily seize on that and say, ah, well, that's the problem then. Here are these scribes and Pharisees, and on their minds as they put their money into the collection plate and as they close their eyes and direct their petitions to God, and as they allow meal times to pass without partaking of any food, always on their minds as they do this stuff is a reward to which they're looking forward. That's the problem. But of course, you only have to glance at verses 1 and 4 and 6 to see that that interpretation is untenable. Because according to those verses, Jesus' disciples are also in the business of receiving a reward. In fact, in verses 4 and 6, Jesus is inviting his disciples to have always on their minds, in their giving and their praying, a reward to which they're looking forward to. And if that surprises us then this morning, I think there's probably a reason for that. And let me just establish 2 points quickly before I tell you what that reason is. Point number one, the reward then that Jesus' disciples are going to receive is in the age to come. Remember back in chapter 5, verse 12, "Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven." And it's very unlikely that now in this same discourse, Jesus suddenly uses this same word, reward, with a different meaning. No, the reward in chapter 6 is the same as the reward in chapter 5. It relates to the age to come. And then point number 2, to have that reward on our minds is, according to at least one New Testament passage, the definition of faith. Listen to Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. Now, we would all agree with that without any question. And we would all agree then that if our giving and our praying is going to please God, then faith must be present. Faith, if faith is absent, it's not going to please God. But then in the second half of that verse, the writer to the Hebrews defines the faith he's talking about. For whoever would draw near to God must believe, what? Must believe, first of all, that he exists. Well, that's fairly obvious. And secondly, that he rewards those who seek him. And again, in the context of Hebrews 10 and 11, the reward relates to the age to come. So get that then. Things don't please God if faith is absent from them. And faith is looking forward to a reward in the age to come. So I come back to what I was saying a moment ago. If it surprises us this morning that Jesus here brings in the R word, reward, when encouraging his disciples to give and to pray and to fast, the reason is probably not that we're so holy. And, you know, this strikes us therefore as somewhat mercenary, because, you know, we're into giving for its own sake and praying for its own sake without any other considerations being brought into the equation. I don't think that's the reason. The reason is that for us, anticipation of the world to come, looking to the reward, as it's put in Hebrews 11:26, pressing on towards the goal to win the prize for which God has called us heavenwards in Christ Jesus, it's so often an add-on, isn't it, in our Christian lives? It's something to which we have recourse at funeral services. It's one aspect of our general Christian outlook. It's not definitive of what we are as Christians. It doesn't pervade everything we do. We don't see it as that faith without which it is impossible to please God. But it is that. Anticipation of the reward to come is that faith without which it is impossible to please God. And so may God help us all to be reward-focused Christians. So the problem is not the righteousness. The problem is not the reward. Thirdly, the problem is not the realization. The problem is not the realization. What I mean by that then is others realizing that we're doing these things. Others realizing that we're giving. Others realizing that we're praying. Now, if all we had was this passage, we might reasonably conclude that these activities Jesus is talking about, they must always be practiced in secret. And that if they're not being practiced in secret, then they're being practiced pharisaically and they come under Jesus' condemnation here. We might conclude that. But of course, this passage isn't all that we have. We have, for instance, the book of Acts, whose early chapters describe for us what life was like in the church in Jerusalem following Jesus' ascension into heaven. And we discover there the monetary gifts of church members being laid at the apostles' feet. Barnabas, you remember, brought a monetary gift and laid it at the apostles' feet. Now, we don't know exactly how public that action was, but clearly the apostles knew about Barnabas' gift. Clearly Luke knew about Barnabas' gift because he tells us about it in the pages of Acts. Yet there's no indication then that that realization by others somehow invalidated Barnabas' gift. And what we discover in those chapters of Acts regarding monetary gifts, we discover even more emphatically regarding prayer. Prayer in the Jerusalem church was certainly done publicly. The believers gathered together to pray. They did it in that waiting period prior to the day of Pentecost. They did it when Peter and John had just been released after a night in jail and a rebuke from the Sanhedrin. They did it when Peter was being detained by Herod. Indeed, praying together was one of those things, along with the apostles' teaching and the fellowship and the breaking of bread, to which they devoted themselves. And necessarily then, if you opened your mouth and prayed in that context of a prayer meeting, others realized that you were praying. And again, that doesn't seem to invalidate the praying, the fact that others realized that it was being done. So I'm saying then that when we bring other passages from the New Testament to bear on this passage, indeed, when we even just go to the very next section and Jesus' famous prayer, which begins, "Our Father in heaven," not "my Father," "our Father in heaven," when we bring other passages to bear on this passage, it becomes evident that realization, that is, others realizing that we're giving, others realizing that we're praying, that cannot be the problem. Now, you might well ask, well, what are we to make then of Jesus' emphasis on secrecy here? Well, I think we can put it like this. To often engage in these activities secretly is a good way of warding off the problem. Indeed, if you never engage in these activities secretly, you can be pretty sure that you've succumbed to the problem, which is a challenging thought, I guess, for those of us who often pray in public. We must always make sure, as Don Carson puts it, our public praying is simply the overflow of our private praying. But nonetheless, engaging in these activities publicly, whereby others realize we're engaging in them, that is not itself the problem. And perhaps I do need to stress that this morning, because we live, do we not, in a highly individualistic culture. There's probably never been a more individualistic culture than the one that we live in. Which means then that if we as Christians ever think much about prayer at all, we are going to be culturally predisposed to think in terms of individual, private prayer. And if we're familiar with this passage then in Matthew 6, what we can then do is clothe what is really, as I say, a cultural predisposition with a cloak of piety. And we can say, praying with others, you know, that's a dubious business, where hypocrisy always lurks just beneath the surface. Jesus talks here about going into your room and shutting the door. So I'm going to focus on that rather than on the church prayer meeting, because that's the purer, holier option. We need to be careful that we don't go down that route, that we don't make this passage a pretext for what is really a very unbiblical individualism. Yes, Matthew 6 is certainly important. Every Christian should pray privately. And I'll say more about that this evening. But let's be faithful to biblical proportions here. The New Testament speaks far more about corporate praying than about private praying. We must not let the church prayer meeting die. We mustn't let it become like pews and flower arrangements and hymn books. A feature of 20th century evangelical Christianity that's now fallen by the wayside, unsuited to the exigencies of modern life. It's okay for pews and flower arrangements and hymn books to fall by the wayside, but not the church prayer meeting. As I recently heard Sinclair Ferguson say, it's the meeting for prayer that says everything about our desire for the presence and blessing of God. It's the meeting for prayer that says everything about our desire for the presence and blessing of God. So let's get away from this perhaps rather convenient idea then, that doing stuff like prayer in a public setting where others realize that we're doing it, that's suspect, that's dubious. No, the realization, that's not the problem. So, we've established so far then that it's proper to engage in this branch of righteousness, what I've termed religious righteousness. And we've established that it's proper to do so with a view to a reward. And we've established that it's proper to do so in a public setting where others realize that we're doing it. And so this question is more acute than ever then, what's the problem? What's deficient about what the scribes and Pharisees are doing? What's the problem of which Jesus is warning with this strong word, beware? Well, that takes us to our fourth heading then. The problem is the reasons. The problem is the reasons. Not the righteousness, not the reward, not the realization. The reasons. Because lying behind these activities that we've been talking about this morning then can be wrong reasons. I mean, throughout this discourse, Jesus has been so concerned, hasn't he, with the heart. Remember how we talked about that in relation to those eight statements, the Beatitudes as we normally term them. And we said then that of those eight, three relate to external actions, and five relate to the inner person, relate to the heart. And that proportion then is unlikely to be accidental. And then, of course, as Jesus has gone on in this discourse, he has been there in chapter 5, in the as we've already said, from verse 21 onwards, he has been tackling this approach to moral righteousness where the heart is overlooked. And you're only interested in external actions. So murder is only external murder, and adultery is only external adultery. Well, now in his approach to religious righteousness, again then he's concerned about the heart, and here then the heart being in the wrong place. A whole set of wrong reasons for doing these activities prevailing there in the heart. And he mentions then, I would suggest, three wrong reasons. One explicitly and two implicitly. So a first wrong reason then that can be there in doing these activities, a longing to impress. A longing to impress. And that's the main one, isn't it? That's the explicit one here in these verses. So that's how he begins, isn't it? Beware of practicing your righteousness before other people. But we said he doesn't stop there, because sometimes it's fine to practice your righteousness before other people. But this is the point. In order to be seen by them. That's the reason you're doing it. To impress them. You want to impress these people before whom you're doing it. Or as he puts it in verse 2 regarding giving, that you may be praised by others. And of course he has that rather amusing, presumably hyperbole. Perhaps there were people who did announce their giving by blasting trumpets. Probably he's been a little bit over the top, but he's making a point here. That, okay, they don't actually do that, but they would like to if they could get away with it. They like to go around blasting trumpets before they give, these people I'm talking about. Now, applying this then to our situation, this doing the kind of activities we've been talking about this morning, particularly giving and praying, doing these activities out of an underlying longing to impress. In terms of applying that to our situation, I guess one of the advantages of living in this increasingly post-Christian culture is that that is going to be less of a problem to us. Because I suppose in former generations that if you were the kind of person who prayed a lot, for instance, then people generally would be quite impressed with that, whether they were Christians or not. That would just be something that people would be quite impressed by. Oh, you're a holy man, a religious man. You pray a lot. Whereas in our context, increasingly, you're just looked on as a bit odd and a bit strange if you pray. So one of the advantages of our post-Christian culture is that It perhaps lessens in society generally this temptation to long to impress people with our praying. But there's still our church subculture. And we need to be careful there then, don't we? That we're not doing our praying and our giving and things with a longing to impress. And we think of even just a simple phrase that we sometimes say to each other, I'm praying for you. Perhaps the person's going through some situation or something's happening, say, I'm praying for you. And of course that can be a great encouragement, and that's certainly not a wrong thing to say to a Christian brother or sister. But that simple phrase can be accompanied by dangers, can't it? For one thing, it could be that we're not really praying for the person. And we just want to encourage them. And we think, well, it's an encouraging thing to say. It's a bit of a Christian cliche, like, you know, God bless you. Well, I'm praying for you. And we're actually, of course, lying if we're not praying for them at all. But then it could be that we are praying for them. But we're telling them that we're praying for them, not so much or not merely to encourage them, but because we want them to know we pray. You know, we're really faithful and we're really regular in prayer. I'm saying it's subtle, and we need to be careful, don't we? That there isn't this desire to impress, this longing to impress that is driving some of our praying or giving or whatever it might be. So that's one wrong reason, a longing to impress. Secondly, a delight in self. A delight in self. And this is one of the more implied wrong reasons then, because verse 3 is intriguing, isn't it? Jesus is talking about giving, and he says, when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. So here then, he's going beyond the problem of doing it to be seen by others, and he's saying that there's even a problem of doing it to be seen by yourself. I think John Stott captures this very well. He says, so subtle is the sinfulness of the heart that it is possible to take deliberate steps to keep our giving secret from men while simultaneously dwelling on it in our own minds in a spirit of self-congratulation. And we know perhaps what that means. You've gotten up early and you've spent time in prayer, and you kind of go into the rest of the day with a spring in your step, kind of feeling all jaunty, and you're kind of whistling on your way into work or whatever it might be. And it's not that jauntiness is flowing from the actual communion with God itself. It's not that something lives in every hue Christ's eyes have never seen. It's rather flowing from the thought, I've been in communion with God. Not the communion itself, but I've been in communion with God. What a prayer warrior I am. You know, I'm a bit like those guys I've read the biographies about now, who gets up early in the morning and prays. And it's not then that we're telling anybody else about it. It's not to be seen by others, but there's just this delight in our own hearts, in our own religiosity. And again, we need to watch out for that, don't we? As Stott says, so subtle is the sinfulness of the heart. So there can be a longing to impress, there can be a delight in self. Or then a third wrong reason, a spirit of unbelief. A spirit of unbelief. And again, this is even more subtly implied, I think. But a fascinating phrase that Jesus uses in verse 6, where he says, when you pray, go into your room and shut the door and pray to your Father who is in secret. God is in secret. What on earth does that mean? I think Jesus there is referring probably to God's invisibility. The fact that God is a hidden God. We don't see him. And some of you may dimly recall I preached regarding God's invisibility some months ago and said that in the New Testament, God's invisibility, it's a great thing. It's not something that we need to be apologetic about and on the back foot about, but rather this is a wonderful thing. And the New Testament writers were living in cities that were filled with silly, visible gods on every street corner, and they were just so self-evidently pathetic. And what a beautiful thing then to worship a God who is other and you can't see him or touch him. He doesn't have this silly smiling face every time you walk into work in the morning. But of course, to unbelievers, the invisibility of God isn't like that. It isn't beautiful and precious. It's something that they sneer at. What kind of a God is this that you can't even see? And we can be affected by that, perhaps. And we can start to think, almost without admitting it to ourselves, we can start to think perhaps negatively about God's invisibility. And no, we don't become atheists or anything, but just subtly in the back of our minds affected by this. And in relation then to our Christian activities, it kind of pushes us perhaps toward those that are more public in their nature. Praying in a prayer meeting, studying the Bible with others. And it's not necessarily to impress, in this case, to impress other people. John Piper talks about the danger of wanting to be seen by others when we're praying or studying the Bible or whatever, to encourage them to do the same. And of course, in and of itself, that may not be a bad thing, but if that's all we're doing, it could be it's because in our heart of hearts we've been affected by this unbelief, and we're not convinced fully that an hour or half an hour or even 10 minutes spent just me and God together is worthwhile. Just me and this invisible God in a room, and there's no one else being helped or encouraged or benefited by that. We're not thoroughly convinced that that is absolutely worthwhile. And it's another reason why Jesus is saying, you need to pray privately. Yes, pray publicly as well, but you need to pray privately to make sure that there is that sense within your heart that doing something that is 100% Godward and involves nobody else is worthwhile. Well, this morning's sermon, I'm aware then, has not been a jolly affair. A sermon, the mood of a sermon must be regulated by the mood of the passage, mustn't it? And Jesus begins this passage, beware. And any passage that begins beware, we need to take seriously and we need to be sobered by. And I guess for any of us who are Christians, this whole area of insincerity, hypocrisy, it has to be a challenge. It has to be something that we're battling with. C.S. Lewis writes in one of his essays about how there are greater possibilities for sinning for Christians than there are for non-Christians. Let me quote to you what he says. He says, for the supernatural entering a human soul opens to it new possibilities of both good and evil. From that point, the road branches, one way to sanctity, love, humility, the other to spiritual pride, self-righteousness, persecuting zeal, and no way back to the mere humdrum virtues and vices of the unawakened soul. If the divine call does not make us better, it will make us very much worse. And then this, of all bad men, religious bad men are the worst. Of all created beings, the wickedest is one who originally stood in the immediate presence of God. We have inestimable privileges as men and women into whose lives the living God has come. But it brings with us huge dangers. And we must make sure that we're fighting the danger of hypocrisy, insincerity. Perhaps for some of you, the big issues that Jesus has been dealing with in chapter 5, they're not particularly live ones. But I suspect for all of us, this is an issue. May God help us by his Spirit to fight this battle for his glory. Amen.